Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 119.
And this is the chaotic climax of the narrative that somehow manages to synthesize a mystical disappearance, a devastating kidnapping plot, a rescue by a total social anomaly, and a whiplash-inducing intervention of imperial law.
It's a lot to unpack. The board is set, but the pieces are wildly out of position.
Yeah, give us a quick lay of the land here. What's the state of the Gia family right now?
Well, the once impenetrable Gia family is fundamentally fractured, stripped of their aristocratic titles, their wealth confiscated, the patriarchs are exiled.
Basically, the estate is bleeding out.
Precisely. The vulnerability of the Gia estate at this specific juncture really cannot be overstated. With the patriarchal figures absent, the structural integrity of the household is just collapsing inward.
So into this absolute vacuum, we place our two central scholars, Bayou and his nephew Jialan.
Right, and they are preparing for the ultimate trial, which is the imperial provincial exam.
And while the entire household's attention is fixated on this desperate bid to reclaim their status, the unprotected flanks of the family are left entirely exposed.
Exposed to predators from within their own walls, which is the scariest part.
Which introduces our core exploration today, you know, the total illusion of structural control. We want you to think about how the rigid systems we rely on, family, law, society, can function as both cages and weapons.
That dual nature is so central to this whole chapter.
Yeah. And we begin in this eerie calm before the storm. We have Baoyu, the heir, just kind of moving through the motions of his final societal duties.
But he's broadcasting this quiet, chilling detachment while doing it.
He is. He's speaking to the servant Yinger in riddles, right?
Mm-hmm.
He predicts her future good fortune solely because she is tethered to someone possessing innate spiritual luck.
But then he explicitly targets Shirin, who historically is his closest, most intimate maid, and he brands her as, quote, unreliable.
Unreliable. I mean, that is harsh.
It is devastating when you understand the trajectory of Shirin's character. She has always functioned as the ultimate pragmatist within the Gia household.
Because she's the one always pushing him to study, right?
Exactly. She has continuously aligned herself with the material survival of the family, urging Baoyu to conform to secure his bureaucratic future.
So by calling her unreliable now, he isn't questioning her loyalty to the family per se.
No, not at all. He is identifying her absolute irrelevance to the spiritual exodus he is about to undertake.
Oh, wow. That makes sense.
Yeah, her reliability is anchored to a sinking ship of material existence. Yinger, conversely, is unburdened by those grand architectural ambitions of the estate.
Which allows her a totally different kind of karmic survival. It's a terrifying moment of clairvoyance from Baoyu.
He's essentially reading the underlying code of his own universe, just casually observing the people around him and forecasting their spiritual trajectories.
Meanwhile, the rest of the household is entirely consumed by the logistics of the impending exam.
Oh, they are frantic. Lady Wang and Li Wan are practically vibrating with terror at the prospect of sending Baoyu and Jialan into the examination compound.
And we should clarify for you listening, this isn't just normal performance anxiety. It is physical terror.
Right. These are men who have never existed outside the heavily insulated, meticulously curated ecosystem of the Gia compound.
The psychological threshold they're crossing is just immense.
Lady Wang's terror stems from this sudden, unavoidable collision with reality. For their entire lives, these heirs have been the focal points of a massive solar system of servants and guards.
And the examination hall is the great equalizer, isn't it?
It absolutely is. It strips away all that aristocratic padding. They are transitioning from an environment where their every physical need is anticipated
to a highly regulated, austere cell where they are completely solitary.
Exactly. It is an isolation they are biologically unprepared to endure.
So the family's reaction is to try and construct a mobile version of that protective bubble.
Mm.
They rally this army of servants just to escort them through the crowds.
Yet Bayou's reaction to this frantic maternal anxiety is utterly opaque.
He's just totally withdrawn. Like, he has been in a state of profound withdrawal since the earlier visit from that mysterious monk.
And his essays, which he previously despised writing, have suddenly achieved an unnatural, flawless perfection.
It's an acceleration of mastery that fundamentally unnerves the family, doesn't it?
Because it feels less like dedicated study and more like a supernatural download of information that he no longer even values.
Which brings us to the farewell sequence. And I mean, this is such a heavy moment.
It is a masterclass in layered intention. Baoyu changes into a very deliberate outfit clothes that are half new and half old.
A visual manifestation of a man caught between two realms.
Precisely. Honoring the present while carrying the weight of his past, So he approaches his mother, Lady Wang, kneels, and touches his head to the floor 3 times.
And the weeping here is crucial, right?
Very much so. He tells her that he possesses only this single entrance into the exam to write an essay that will secure his status as a chosen scholar.
He states that once he delivers this triumph, his lifelong duties are complete. His past transgressions are absolved.
Now, I want to push back on the emotional mechanics of that scene for a second.
Okay.
Because to a casual observer, this looks like the ultimate submission to filial expectation. But beneath the surface, it feels almost cruel.
Cruel because he knows he's leaving.
Right. He knows the devastation his departure will cause. If his ultimate goal is to sever his earthly tethers and embrace the empty gate of Buddhism, why orchestrate this elaborate, high-stakes performance?
That's a great question. If the material world is just an illusion, why not just walk out the front gates of the compound that very morning? Why even sit for the exam at all?
Because true detachment cannot be achieved through theft or abscondment. In the cosmological framework of this narrative, you cannot simply abandon a debt.
It has to be paid in full to nullify its karmic weight.
Exactly. Lady Wang gave him his physical form. To abandon her without recompense would be a violent rupture that leaves him spiritually anchored to her suffering.
Oh, so by achieving the degree, he is not endorsing the imperial system.
Not at all. He is weaponizing it to generate the exact currency required to buy out his own contract of existence.
Wow. It is a staggering act of empathy and ruthlessness combined.
He is handing his mother the ultimate societal artifact, a flawless scholar for a son, knowing full well it is an empty vessel.
He is paying his exit tax. Think about that in your own life. How many obligations are you fulfilling simply to pay off expectations before you could pursue your own path?
It's a very relatable concept, even today.
It is. Sort of like a burned-out CEO who works relentlessly to deliver one final record-breaking quarterly earnings report.
Yeah, not to get a bonus, but just to drop the mic and vanish without guilt.
That's exactly it. And he doesn't even try to hide his trajectory. He invokes his deceased grandmother during this farewell.
Asserting that physical separation does not equate to spiritual separation, which is a clear declaration that he is about to become physically absent.
And then he turns, walks out, and erupts into wild laughter. He quotes, "Going to the peerless place for fame and wealth, breaking out of the first gate of the cage."
The architecture of that metaphor is brilliant. The peerless place for fame and wealth is the examination compound.
The very epicenter of earthly ambition.
Right. It's the mechanism that perpetuates the illusion of power. For thousands of scholars, it is a doorway into the labyrinth of bureaucracy and status.
But for Baiyu, it is an airlock.
He is using the epicenter of the material world to eject himself from it. The first gate of the cage isn't something he circumvents. He has to walk directly through its center to shatter it.
And the moment he steps through that airlock, the pressure within the Jia compound destabilizes violently.
It really does. With Baiyu gone and the patriarchs exiled, the estate is hollowed out.
So we pivot from Baiyu's pursuit of spiritual erasure directly into the grotesque machinery of a hostile takeover.
While Baiyu is discarding the world, the marginalized elements of his own family are desperate to scavenge the remains.
Which brings us to Jia Huan.
Yes. We enter the territory of Jia Huan. As the son of a concubine, he has lived his entire life in the shadow of the primary branch.
Stewing in this potent mixture of resentment and manufactured inferiority.
In the absence of the patriarchal enforcers, acts as a chemical catalyst for his dormant malice.
He recognizes that the structural deterrents of the estate have evaporated.
He observes the landscape and basically declares himself the temporary sovereign of this vacuum.
It's like a malicious middle manager orchestrating a hostile corporate takeover the very minute the boss goes on vacation.
That's a perfect analogy. His calculation is entirely predatory. He zeroes in on Qiaoji, his own young niece.
Who is left completely unprotected.
And Jia Huan conspires to literally traffic her, plotting to sell her to a foreign prince as a concubine.
And he orchestrates this through Qiaoji's own grandmother, Lady Xing. I have to pause here. She is her own grandmother. How does she justify selling her off so quickly?
It's awful, I know. Lady Xing's complicity requires careful dissection. Jia Huan doesn't appeal to her familial duty.
He targets her immediate financial panic.
And her political ambition. He constructs a narrative where selling Qiaoji yields a massive bride price.
And theoretically, curries political favor that could alleviate her exiled husband's circumstances.
Lady Xing weaponizes her generational seniority to legitimize an atrocity.
Because she occupies a higher tier, in the ancestral hierarchy than the absent Jialian, she can just override his paternal rights.
It is a horrifying demonstration of how absolute hierarchical authority, when stripped of its moral anchor, simply becomes a mechanism for cannibalism.
It's a systemic failure at the highest level.
Totally. Jia Huan and his accomplice, Jia Yun, accelerate the timeline to an absurd degree, finalizing the contracts and accepting the foreign silver.
With the intention of physically removing the girl in a mere 3 days. They are relying on the sheer speed of the transaction to outpace any resistance.
But then the entire mechanism jams.
And it doesn't jam because someone within the family hierarchy suddenly remembers their moral compass, does it?
No, not at all. The plot disintegrates because of imperial liability.
Explain that for us.
Well, the transaction collapses upon contact with the bureaucratic reality of the foreign prince's representatives. They conduct a rudimentary assessment of the Jia family's current political standing, and they recoil.
Because the Jia family is currently designated as a legally penalized, disgraced noble house.
Exactly. Their assets were recently seized by the emperor. From the perspective of the foreign prince, integrating a daughter from a radioactive political entity into his household is an unacceptable risk.
It could trigger imperial scrutiny on them.
Right. The prince's agents reject the girl not out of pity, but out of a desperate need to avoid contagion.
It is an incredible paradox. The very disgrace that destroyed the Jia family's power is the exact shield that deflects the kidnapping.
If the family were still in high standing, Kyoji would have been sold without a second thought.
Her vulnerability as a member of a criminal household becomes her ultimate armor against the foreign prince.
Which leaves Jia Huan and Jia Yun completely exposed, promised the asset, and now have no way to fulfill the contract.
Thrusting Kyoji into even deeper peril as they scramble to cover their tracks.
This specific mechanism of failure really exposes the fragility of power dynamics.
When internal morality evaporates, the only remaining constraints are external liabilities.
It forces an examination of the invisible tripwires within deeply corrupt systems. The predators within the family were perfectly aligned, but they failed to account for the risk-averse nature of institutional power.
Notice how quickly internal alliances shift when authority is absent in your own life. Have you ever seen an organization descend into chaos the moment the standard rule setter steps out of the room?
It happens all the time.
It really does. But while Jia Huan is panicking, the actual matriarch of the primary household, Lady Wang, and her fiercely loyal lieutenant, Ping Er, uncover the plot.
And this is where the narrative practically screams at us about the paralysis of the aristocracy.
Lady Wang possesses immense theoretical power. She commands vast resources.
Yet, when confronted with Lady Xing's mandate to sell her granddaughter, Lady Wang and Ping Er are reduced to weeping in a locked room.
We have to view this paralysis through the lens of their specific social architecture, right?
Definitely. Lady Wang is not paralyzed by fear of physical violence. She is immobilized by the impenetrable lattice of filial protocol.
Lady Xing holds generational precedence. For Lady Wang to launch a direct assault against Lady Jing's decree would require dismantling the very framework that grants Lady Wang her own authority.
To attack the senior generation is to attack the foundation of the estate itself.
So the system is operating exactly as designed. It simply happens to be designed to protect the commands of the elder, regardless of how depraved they are.
They are trapped in a social checkmate. The rules of engagement forbid them from making a move.
And then, wandering into this suffocating, high-stakes political deadlock, comes an element completely foreign to their ecosystem.
Granny Lu. Granny Lu's arrival is structurally vital here. She is a rural peasant, Kyoji's godmother, and an entity who exists entirely outside the gravitational pull of the Jia state's internal politics.
When Ping Er details this catastrophic, multi-layered kidnapping conspiracy, Granny Lu does not attempt to parse the hierarchical nuances.
She bypasses the political entirely and engages with the kinetic reality of the situation.
I love the mechanics of her solution. It is profoundly devoid of elegance.
It really is. While the noble women are agonizing over the impossibility of confronting Lady Xing, Granny Lu essentially says, "We bypass her completely. We dress the girl in rags, throw her in the back of my agricultural cart, and drive away."
She nullifies the entire crisis by just changing the physical location of the target.
She has the agency to act precisely because she has absolutely no social standing to protect.
Her lack of status is her greatest strategic asset.
Granny Lu operates in a reality governed by seasons, harvests, and physical survival, not face and protocol. To her, a threat is something you physically evade.
This intervention highlights the fatal flaw of the aristocratic mindset. They can only conceive of solutions that operate within their established rules of engagement.
Granny Lu ignores the chessboard entirely and simply walks away with the king,
which forces Lady Wang and Ping Er to operate outside their paradigm.
They execute the plan under the most mundane camouflage imaginable, ordering a carriage to transport an old woman back to her village.
They literally smuggle the bloodline of the primary house out through the service entrance.
But the real friction happens at the back gate. There are guards stationed there, servants whose explicit duty is to monitor the perimeter.
And they let the cart pass.
The compliance of the gatekeepers is a critical thematic pivot. They do not turn a blind eye out of an abstract loyalty to the Jia dynasty.
Nor do they do it because they are oblivious.
Right. They allow the extraction to occur as a direct, localized repayment for the past grace extended to them by Ping Er.
It is a profound shift in the economy of the household. The grand systemic mechanisms of the family failed. The ancestral hierarchy failed.
What actually saves Qiaoji is a microscopic, decentralized network of human empathy.
Ping'er's historical habit of treating the lower-tier servants with dignity generated a hidden reserve of loyalty.
A loyalty that the aristocrats couldn't buy and Jia Huan couldn't anticipate.
It demonstrates that while structural power is brittle and can be seized by bad actors like Jia Huan, interpersonal grace is resilient. It operates completely off the grid.
The gatekeepers recognize the moral authority of Ping Er's kindness, allowing them to quietly mutiny against the systemic authority of the estate.
It is a localized, quiet rebellion that actually alters the destiny of the bloodline.
It begs you to examine the hidden economies within your own environments.
We spend so much time navigating the massive formal structures of our institutions, assuming they will hold up under pressure. Who is the Granny Lu in your life?
Right, the person who ignores the complicated rules and just offers a practical solution. Because when the system inevitably fractures, it is almost always those localized networks of mutual aid that provide the actual extraction route.
You survive the collapse through the back gate, not the boardroom.
Such a powerful takeaway. And just as Qiaoji physically escapes the gravitational pull of the estate through the back gate, the narrative aggressively wrenches our attention back to the epicenter of imperial power.
The examination compound.
We transition from a frantic, tangible evasion to an event that borders on the metaphysical.
The family has prepared this massive reception for the returning scholars. The tension is at its absolute peak.
And then Jialan, the young nephew, walks through the door alone. He is physically depleted and in a state of sheer panic.
When the family interrogates him about Baoyu's location, the timeline he provides is chilling because of how mundane and precise it is.
Jialan recounts that Baoyu performed his duties flawlessly. He finished his essay early, waited patiently for Jialan, and they submitted their papers in tandem.
The critical moment occurs at the Dragon Gate, that massive, singular exit through which thousands of exhausted scholars must pass.
Jialan states they were walking shoulder to shoulder. They were separated by a microscopic margin within the crush of the crowd.
Jialan averts his gaze for a fraction of the second, and when he turns back, the space Baoyu occupied is entirely empty.
This isn't a disappearance in a desolate wilderness. This is a vanishing act at the most heavily surveilled, densely populated choke point in the province.
I mean, it's a classic locker room mystery. He vanished in plain sight, surrounded by crowds and his own family's security detail.
The family immediately deploys search parties. They scour the examination grounds, they interrogate guards, they comb through the returning throngs of candidates.
But the search yields absolutely nothing. It is a spatial impossibility. Baoyu didn't slip away. He simply ceased to occupy the physical space.
The collapse of the household into despair is absolute. Lady Wang, who had anchored her entire psychological survival to this single event, loses consciousness.
The family is thrust into an agonizing limbo, but the agony is almost immediately interrupted by a tectonic shift in the outside world.
The official results of the imperial exam are published.
And the results are staggering. Jialan places a very respectable 130th, which is a triumph in its own right.
But Baoyu achieves 7th place in the entire province.
This isn't just passing the exam. This is ascending to the absolute zenith of the intellectual and bureaucratic elite. He is suddenly a luminary.
This revelation triggers a fascinating debate among the panicked household staff. One of the servants attempts to rationalize the situation,
arguing that a permanent disappearance is now logistically impossible.
Yes. The servant posits that achieving 7th place grants Baoyu immediate, inescapable visibility.
The logic is that you cannot hide when your name and description are suddenly the most valuable commodities in the province.
Fame, in the servant's mind, is an inescapable tracker.
And I find that argument incredibly compelling from a purely material standpoint. I mean, if you are the seventh-ranked scholar, local magistrates, wealthy families looking for sons-in-law, and imperial administrators are all actively hunting for you.
Your anonymity is completely destroyed.
Exactly. How do you just disappear when you're the most famous guy in the province? But the servant's logic assumes that Bao Yu is still operating on the same frequency as the rest of the empire.
It assumes he wants to be found, or at least that he is hiding within the confines of the society that is looking for him.
Precisely. The servant's deduction is flawless if applied to a man who desires the world.
But the family is beginning to realize the terrifying alternative. Fame makes you hyper-visible only to those who value the material realm.
Bai Yu has shifted into an entirely different ontological state.
He hasn't hidden from the gaze of the empire. He has fundamentally dismantled his own reflection.
It is the character Shichun who finally pierces the veil of their denial. Amidst the frantic logistical planning and the weeping, she isolates a single catastrophic detail.
She asks the room if Bai Yu took his jade with him into the examination hall.
The jade. It is the crucial artifact of the entire saga.
It is not a piece of jewelry. It is the physical anchor of his soul. It's the talisman of his earthly existence and his connection to the cosmic realm.
When the family confirms that the jade is gone with him, Shichun articulates the horrifying truth.
This is not a kidnapping. This is not a fugue state. Bai Yu has executed his long-dormant vow.
He has exited the Dragon Gate, the ultimate symbol of imperial authority and material success, and stepped directly through the empty gate of Buddhist monasticism.
The juxtaposition of those two gates is incredible.
It really is. He uses the momentum of the highest earthly achievement to propel himself out of the earthly realm entirely.
It completely recontextualizes his farewell to Lady Wang. He didn't write the seventh place essay to begin a career. He wrote it to close an account.
He handed them the definitive proof of his capability, confirming that his rejection of their world wasn't born of incompetence, but of profound choice.
He gave Lady Wang the scholar she demanded, but he surgically removed the son she loved.
It is a devastating psychological strike.
Yeah.
The family is left holding the ultimate prize, a seventh place provincial ranking, but it is a completely hollow artifact.
The victory itself is the instrument of their bereavement.
And it is precisely at this moment of absolute irrecoverable internal collapse that the macro machinery of the empire decides to arbitrarily resurrect them.
The timing is almost violently absurd. Word of Bayou's seventh place finish, combined with the bizarre mystery of his immediate vanishing, filters up to the highest echelons of the bureaucracy,
eventually reaching the emperor himself.
The emperor, moved by the drama of this brilliant, vanished scholar and recalling the historical loyalty of the Jia ancestors, issues a sweeping set of imperial edicts.
The intervention of the emperor demonstrates the terrifying arbitrary nature of absolute power. With a few strokes of his brush, the emperor initiates a province-wide search for Bai Yu.
But more consequentially for the estate, he pardons the exiled patriarch, Jia Shi.
He legally reinstates the family's aristocratic titles and mandates the return of all their confiscated wealth and properties.
In an instant, the structural damage to the dynasty is entirely repaired.
The family goes from being a legally penalized, financially ruined, leaderless shell to being fully restored to the pinnacle of imperial favor.
It is the deus ex machina of all deus ex machinas.
And riding the wave of this imperial pardon is Jia Lin, Kaoji's father, returning.
As he travels back to the capital, his path intersects with a rustic carriage bringing his daughter back from Granny Liu's village.
Jia Lian's return marks the immediate reassertion of patriarchal dominance. Upon learning of the conspiracy hatched by Jia Huan and Jia Yun during his absence, Jia Lian does not hesitate.
He ruthlessly reestablishes the hierarchical boundaries, swearing severe retribution against the conspirators.
He reclaims his authority with an iron grip. But his response to those who subverted the system to save his daughter is equally profound.
He is overwhelmed by the reality of what occurred in his absence. He tearfully acknowledges the bravery of Lady Wang, the pragmatic genius of Granny Liu, and most importantly, the extreme risk taken by Ping'er.
He makes a silent, resolute vow to elevate Ping'er from her precarious status as a concubine or maid to the highly protected, legally unassailable position of his primary wife.
That internal vow is a seismic shift in the internal politics of the family.
Jia Lian is utilizing his restored patriarchal power to reward the localized empathetic networks that actually kept his bloodline alive when the grand structure failed.
It is an acknowledgement that the formal rules of the estate were toxic, and only the informal economy of grace possessed any actual survival value.
We also get a fascinating glimpse into the alternate reality Kyoji almost entered.
While hiding in the rural expanse, Granny Lou reveals that Kyoji's presence attracted the attention of a highly respected, wealthy rural family, the Zoos, who have a young scholar son.
Granny Lou openly suggests acting as a matchmaker, heavily implying a future for Kyoji far removed from the radioactive politics of the capital.
It is a profound counter-narrative for the next generation. Kyoji has survived the absolute worst of aristocratic maneuvering, literally dodging the human trafficking machinations of her own family.
The narrative suggests that her ultimate salvation does not lie in returning to the restored heights of the Jia estate, but in migrating toward the grounded agrarian stability represented by Granny Lou and the Zhu family.
It implies that true resilience is found by stepping off the imperial ladder entirely.
Which forces us to confront the reality of the Jia family's grand restoration. I look at this climax, and I have to ask, what do they actually win?
They have their titles, their immense wealth is flowing back into their vaults, the patriarchs are back in control, the conspirators will be punished.
It's like winning a massive lottery the day after your house burns down to the ground. The machine is completely rebuilt and functioning perfectly, but the core reason for its existence, Bayou, the heir, the spiritual center of the family, is gone.
You are identifying the bitter irony at the heart of the saga. The physical estate is resurrected, but it is a mausoleum.
The wealth and titles are returned only after the family has been bled dry of its essential vitality.
The restoration is a cosmetic victory that only sharpens the agony of their internal void. They possess everything, and they hold nothing.
Reflect on the concept of too little, too late in your own experience. Have you ever achieved a goal or received a reward, only to realize the reason you wanted in the first place is already gone?
It's a heartbreaking reality to face, and the text refuses to let them celebrate this hollow victory.
Just as the family is attempting to process the shock of their restored wealth and the safe return of Kyoji, the chapter delivers one final brutal blow.
A servant bursts into the room with urgent news. Zirin, the maid Baoyu eerily predicted was unreliable, has suddenly fallen gravely ill and is hovering near death.
It is a masterful, unsettling conclusion to the chapter.